Thanks, and thanks to the organizers for having me here. This is, it's kind of a joy to get out of Connecticut in late winter for us, it's a little bit nicer weather, so this is a lot of fun. I'm gonna try and make clear about halfway through the talk what I mean by weak turbulence. I feel the need to talk about something related to turbulence at this meeting, but the whole first half of the talk, it doesn't really matter. All that matters is that we have complicated flow. So I want to acknowledge first that my postdoc, Doug Kelly, did most of the actual work here, and some of the later stuff has been done by a new graduate student in my lab, Yang Biao. So the focus here, what I really want to talk about is going back to basics, right? Really getting into, we all work with complicated stuff, complicated flow fields. We know that the nonlinearity is important. We know a lot of the things that they do. But I want to get back into seeing how specific can we nail down what aspects of the nonlinear term in Navier-Stokes are leading to what observed behavior. And a lot of my motivation for this comes from just staring at movies like this. We all have the experience of doing a lot of statistical analysis, and it's easy at the end of the day to forget about what it is you're really measuring. So I spend a lot of time staring at movies like this to look for inspiration for interesting things that one can measure. For me, a lot of those make nice pictures, and my sort of gut feeling is that if you can get a nice picture out of something, there's probably interesting science going on behind it. So this is just a movie of tracer particles moving around in our fluid flow, and I'll show you the apparatus in a few slides. A lot of features jump out at you. You certainly see a lot of rotational motion. There's vortices that spin up, they crash into each other, they disappear, other ones spin up in their place. There's vorticity of both signs. A lot of complicated stuff.
Why do they clump?
That is an excellent question that I don't know the answer to. I think it's actually kind of a deep question, but I don't.
It's a compressible flow seeded by small particles.
It's not a compressible flow. It's incompressible.
Incompressible
seeded
particles. Non-inertial surface.
This is, hold that thought for a few minutes.
Very interesting.
And then I'll show you exactly what's going on.
Also staring. I've been tracking, right?
Yeah.
You're doing
these are polystyrene, 50 microns. 50 microns. And there's a scale bar down here, so that's 2 centimeters in the flow. And they look bigger. This is an experiment. Okay. So, for a few words of motivation, the two sort of facets of the nonlinearity that I want to focus on today are one, that we know that chaotic flows mix. So the nonlinearity is responsible for driving efficient mixing. Some nice pictures from Jerry Golub's lab from more than a decade ago now of mixing a dye in a two-dimensional chaotic flow. Last summer we had a geophysical example of mixing oil, which you don't necessarily want to do, but you'd like to know something about where it goes. Right, how efficiently is it going to mix? Where in here is it going to go? Is it going to get into the Gulf Stream? You'd sort of like to know these things. And on the other hand, we know this is I think I had to have one picture of a cloud. Right? Nothing else in this talk has anything to do with clouds or inertial particles, but I have my one picture there. Because clouds are great examples of the fact that turbulent flows or nonlinearity drives the production of small scales. Right? You have large scale motion, which then breaks down into small scales that happens in mixing, and wave breaking, and I've always liked that picture. So these sort of two aspects of what the nonlinear term does, right? You mix in real space, and in some sense you mix in reciprocal space, in Fourier space, both are coming out of the same physics. And I would like to say, to sort of push on that and ask how much can we say about linking those two aspects together? So it's sort of a question of, if you know something about a Lagrangian description and you know something about an Eulerian description, what can I say about the links between those? Which is not a trivial question, right? Certainly from a statistical standpoint, that's a difficult question to answer. So that's where we're going to go. So I promised to talk about the experiment. This will make it clear what you saw in that first movie. So we're working in two dimensions. Two-dimensional flow, aside from being sort of generically interesting, because the dynamics of two-dimensional turbulence are not the same as the dynamics of 3D turbulence, is also a great experimental system for getting to these questions. Because if you only have to measure in a plane, you can measure almost everything. It's much easier than measuring, say, velocity fields in three-dimensional turbulence. So the way we do this, there are the sort of two big canonical ways in the lab to generate two-dimensional flow. One are soap films, and the other are these electromagnetic systems. So we have a big flat piece of glass, measures about, I had wanted to make it a meter on a side, but when you, in America, go to buy stock, it comes in yards, not meters, and the difference between 1 yard and 2 yards is somewhat expensive for this, so we at the end of the day have 86 centimeters on a side here of the measurement, or the whole forest region here. Underneath this piece of glass, and you can see that on the edge, are a whole bunch of permanent magnets. Right, so there's just under. What size? Or they're about half a centimeter in diameter. I'm sorry, half an inch.
1.2.
That's a little.
Yeah, they're spaced 1 inch center to center, so 2.5 centimeters center to center. In a square lattice. They're very strong, so these are the strongest permanent magnets that I could find. So at the surface, you get a field of, say, 0.3, 0.4 Tesla, something like that. So they're very strong magnets.
Hmm? Is the chip your board?
No, on top of the magnet. And then you go, it's a 1/8 inch glass.
It's plus, minus, plus, minus.
Plus, minus, plus, minus in this setup. We have subsequently varied that. So, yeah, so they're arranged in a square lattice of alternating polarity in both directions. So then the way we drive the flow, so the fluid, the working fluid itself is, so this is the cross section of the experiment. It's in blue here. This is just DI water with salt in it, sodium chloride. So the key feature here is that it conducts electricity. So you can run electric current from one electrode to the other side. Then you get J cross B force, which drives fluid motion. And because it's non-intrusive, right, we can generate flow that is very nearly two-dimensional. Right, so you arrange your magnetic field in such a way, and you're forcing in such a way that it's driving 2D flow at any given depth. Certainly, there's a no-slip surface down here, and there's not up at the top, so there is a velocity gradient as you go vertically, but there's no flow, or negligible flow, in the depth direction. So in answer to your question, Jurgen, of where we were looking before, our tracer particles are sitting here on the top surface of that saltwater layer. But if they were just sitting on a free surface, an air-water interface, there would be a pretty big surface tension. Surface tension tends to drive clumping of floating particles. So to get rid of that, we put another layer of pure water on top, which is not forced, it's just passively pulled around, but that gets rid of the surface tension between them, and so the particles don't clump, and we have much longer time to make our measurements.
What are the depths of the thicknesses of layers?
About 4 millimeters each.
4 millimeters each?
Yeah.
How do you know
it's really two-dimensional?
You're very, very careful when you fill it. And if you drive it too hard, or if you wait too long, they will mix.
So you fill it very carefully, and then it's only diffusion.
Right. So what we do is we actually put in the fresh water first, and then we very slowly, from the bottom, pump in the, actually gravity feed in the salt water, and it just raises up everything. If you're careful on that, you can actually do it pretty.
How much more heavy is salt water?
15%.
15%? That's significant. Yeah. So the particles you put in when you put the salt water in?
The particles are mixed into the salt water.
That this way you know that there's a layer too, right?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. You don't paint and you don't have color in there or anything, no.
No.
Just clear. The particles actually tell you that you have two layers.
Particles have the same density as salt water?
They're intermediate. So the part of their polystyrene, so their density is 1.05. So this is 1, this is 1.15, and that's 1.05.
Yeah.
So they naturally want to be at that height.
But they want to pin the layer.
They want to be.
So they're close.
There is no difference in surface tension between salty water and which could cause clumping.
There's not.
No, okay.
At least not in the bulk. There may be sort of instantaneous things, but
you check that if you wait long enough, they aren't going to cluster just, you know, without any flow. It's a good check because when we
definitely do that, if you have
for half an hour, it's a cluster.
They do this anyway.
Yeah, well, there is this Cheerios effect. I mean, which is always because every just you know.
Right.
But why is it a matter of time scale?
Wouldn't surfactants go to that layer two because you have what charged on one side, less charged on the other.
I mean, surfactants pose actually some problems for us. So we do add a little bit of surfactant.
Uh-huh.
but we add it with the particles themselves to try to coat the particles again so that they don't stick together. Because if they come really close, the lubrication will...
The surfactant, the particles will stick.
Yeah, because these are, they come as a dry powder. So you have to break them up and everything. Yeah.
So
50 microns, which is actually overkill for us. They'll follow the flow even if they were 100 microns, certainly.
Yeah.
I figure there's no reason, they're the same price. And they sell them by volume. So I get more particles if I have them smaller and I can still see them. So they're fluorescent particles. So what you were actually seeing was fluorescence before. So they absorb in the blue and fluoresce in the green, and we have nice bright blue LEDs that we light everything up with. And image from the top. So we have a 4-megapixel camera that we look down at the top from and we watch them all zip around.
So you do fluorescence?
We do fluorescence. Yeah, with a filter, right, because otherwise you get glare off of the surface. So we measure the flow field using PTV, particle tracking velocimetry. So lots of little pictures like this, lots of little dots. You have a movie of these. The wonderful thing about this flow, too, as an experimentalist, is that nothing is all that fast. Top speeds are about a centimeter per second. So we don't need to image in really ridiculously quickly. We're imaging at 60 hertz here. So that's, you can then get more pixels in your camera. So a whole bunch of movies turns into particle tracks, differentiate the trajectories, get velocity fields. They're very, very dense, so then it's very reasonable for us to differentiate those, or to do finite differences to get derivatives of the velocity field. To give you a sense of that, so we're tracking, in the data I'll show here, we tracked about, we have about a 20 centimeter square measurement volume. Remember, the thing is 86 centimeters wide, so we're looking in the middle. The sidewalls are very far away. In that region, we're tracking about 35,000 particles. We've recently been able to push that to about 100,000. So we have a very, very densely sampled field. we're actually then taking those velocity fields, and to do Lagrangian measurements, we then just plop down on the computer little points and integrate the equations of motion.
With that kind of density, you don't have particle-particle interactions?
They're still 10 or 15 diameters apart on the average.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why it's nice to keep them small. So we don't expect any interactions there.
The motion in the two layers of fluids is not the same.
Probably not, no.
But you are measuring a velocity that is in between the velocity of...
So we're measuring one plane.
There is something like a boundary layer, and you're measuring the velocity inside the boundary layer?
The gradient's very steep. So I think it's unlikely. I think we're sort of in the part where the velocity field is fairly, that the depth dependence is not that strong at this level. It's hard to say exactly. Okay, so once we have the data, then we can start to play all sorts of games, right? And so the first thing I want to talk about is what I would sort of call a Lagrangian effect of nonlinearity. That is, that if you take material areas, in this case, not volumes because we're only 2D, and you watch them go, they will change their shape. They will deform, and you'll get strong mixing. So in general, right, you have some material area, let's call it a circle because that's convenient. Under the action of some flow field U over some time tau D, it will have some other shape, right? It can rotate, it can stretch, it can bend around, do all sorts of things. And if you want to characterize how the shape has changed, you can break that into two kinds of geometric deformation, right? The first part you can say is that you can break this into one part that is affine, right? So any kind of linear operator that you can apply to this shape to turn it into something else. Right, so a matrix transform. So you take whatever your initial shape was, apply a linear operator, you get something else. And there's very few kinds of deformation that you can capture with an affine operator. Right? You can do translation, you can do rotation, shear, dilation, and compression, and that's it. And we're going to then, what we're actually going to wind up doing is measuring this and measuring then everything that isn't affine. This is an idea that was... the first place I saw it was in a paper from Michael Falk and Jim Langer, a little more than 10 years ago, where they were using this to try to look at plasticity in glassy solids. We're going to take the same tools and look at this deformation in a fluid, and we're going to find different results. So the first thing we're going to define then, using this affine part, is some kind of linear affine deformation, sort of mean squared deformation, which is the difference between this sort of best fit affine deformation and your original shape. And then the way we actually do this is we measure the shape at the beginning, we measure the shape at the end of some material area, we do a least squares fit of an affine model to it. Then we can extract this part, right, because we have the best fit matrix operator that took you from one shape to the other, and you also have the residual from that fit. And as long as the noise is low, the residual is telling you not that your system was noisy, it's telling you how bad your model did. And in this case, if the model was linear deformation, the residual is telling us how much nonlinear or non-affine deformation we had. So we can extract independently these two quantities.
Why are they squared?
Yes.
Because it's a least squares fit. So it's sort of, you can think of these as the sort of, if you took the averages, you'd be talking about mean squared deformation, which we will do in a moment. So to sort of get everyone situated, I'm going to show you what this looks like for one particular little circle that we put down in the flow field. So a whole bunch of Lagrangian tracers on a ring and let them go. And what you're going to see, so in gray underneath here, there will be this circle will sit there, so you see what the original size was. In blue will be the actual measured shape of the area, and in red will be the best fit affine deformation. And then what I'm going to plot down here is the ratio of the non-affine part to the affine part as a function of time. And at short times, it does exactly what you would expect, right? The affine fit's very good. Everything, the evolution is essentially linear. You squash down into an ellipse. But then you wait a little bit longer, and things don't look, the affine fit doesn't look very good anymore. You sort of get this banana-shaped thing. The ratio here is growing. It doesn't have to grow monotonically, right? It can decrease again. Then you wait long enough, and it just starts to skyrocket. And the affine fit does very, very poorly. Again, that's not surprising, right? That's what you would expect to happen.
It's exponentially growing this time, initially, on average.
No. You'll see in a second. Right, so this is fairly generic, and you get lots of different shapes. So just four different circles put down at different places in the flow field, and time evolves from left to right, and you see you wind up in all cases, in most cases, the affine fit doesn't do very well, but there's different final shapes that you get. So to answer your question, Grisha, this is what you get then if you just ask about spatial average. So take a whole bunch of these little circles, plop them down in your flow field, let them all go, calculate these things as these two measures of deformation as a function of time, and take the spatial average. In red, this is the linear part, the affine part, which increases not unlike a power law. It's not a great power law, and there's no reason for me necessarily to expect power law per se, but it increases. That's sort of the message I want to get across here, right? So you start at a small value, and you just sort of monotonically increase, right? Things stretch. If you look at the nonlinear part, it also does what you expect down here, right? It's much, much, much smaller at short times than the affine part. At short times, all deformation is roughly linearized, and that makes sense. But if you wait long enough, then there's this sort of knee here, where the non-affine part starts to grow rapidly and eventually crosses and starts to win, starts to dominate. And again, here's just another set of snapshots of one particular...
This probably depends a lot on the initial size.
It depends to some degree on the initial size. I don't have the picture here, but we checked that. We did a whole bunch of things. So these are all... for this data, it's all circles that started much, much smaller than the magnet spacing, which is the dominant forcing scale in the flow.
It depends logarithmically on it, which means not very strong.
Experimentally, you just have the particle, individual particle position.
Yes, but then we
found a circle.
Then what we do is we make velocity fields from those, and then integrate.
You lower it.
It's imaginary circle.
It's not Lagrangian, it's Eulerian.
No, it's Lagrangian. We have a whole
particles.
We have many velocity fields spaced very closely in time. So then what we then do is numerically plop down any point we want and integrate its equations of motion through those measured velocity fields. So another thing that we checked actually was the dependence of all these statistics on how many points you parameterize your circle with. I think these measurements are all with 12, which is well into the range where things stop depending very much on how many points you have. Certainly if you put down, you know, 3 or 4, it's going to start changing a lot. As you put more and more points down on this circle, it stops changing very much.
What do you have any comparison what you would do on a random flow?
What do you mean by a random flow?
So random components of velocity on a plane.
You just mix up the sequence of quantity assumptions.
Yeah. I haven't tried it.
Well, it is a random flow.
With a time correlation.
It's not white.
It's not white.
But it has a finite correlation time.
It has a finite correlation time, yes.
Which means random.
Random but smooth, we'll say, yeah? Okay. So then you start to think about what's going on here, right? So this part, the affine part, I would argue is really a measure of stretching in this flow. So essentially, you can relate this, or you can think about it in the same sense as you would a Lyapunov exponent, a finite time Lyapunov exponent, which again is getting at the stretching in the flow. It's a different linearization of the advection, but it's still a linearization of the advection. And if you measure the mean squared average Lyapunov exponent in this flow, you get a curve that almost exactly maps this one. The scale is a little bit different, but the shape of it is almost exactly the same. So then you think back to everything we know about chaos, and you say, okay, if that's stretching, well, what's one thing you can't do with a linear operator? You can't fold. And of course, chaotic mixing is built of stretching and folding. And I really like this picture. I stole this from somewhere on Google Images. This is your sort of classic baker's map, actually done with pastry dough. And what I really like about that is the first mention of stretching and folding I found in the literature is an 1894 Nature paper from Reynolds, where he actually talks about it in terms of bakers. So the baker's map has a long history.
Really?
It's very cute. He had an experiment. He was describing an experiment where he had a lot of different colored lines that he put into a fluid, and he stirred it very carefully, and he watched them stretch and fold back on themselves. Right, so essentially what we're able to do here is isolate these two components of the mixing process, right? The stretching from the folding. That's what I would argue. But mean squared quantities can only tell you so much. One of the nice things about this experiment is we have a lot of spatial, we can define things spatially. So if we look at now spatial maps of these quantities, here's just a sort of snapshot of the vorticity and velocity field on a very small subregion in the middle of the flow. This panel on the left here, this is what you get for the spatial distribution of that affine component of the deformation. And the two different colors are changing the direction of time. Right, so if you're asking about deformation, you can either ask about the deformation that your little piece of fluid has experienced or what deformation it will experience. And there's been a lot of work done on this kind of thing in the past 10 years or so, and you can relate these strong red and blue lines to the stable and unstable manifolds of finite lived hyperbolic fixed points. So those hyperbolic points live at the crossings here. Right. So this field, if you've ever seen the quantity that goes by the buzzword of Lagrangian coherent structures, this looks very, very similar, which is not again surprising. LCS you get out of doing Lyapunov exponents, this you get out of a different linearization, but it's still a linearization, so it should look the same. Then you look at on the right panel here at the spatial distribution of the non-affine component. And the first thing you see is that you get very disappointed because it looks very similar. Right? Again, that's not surprising when you think about it, because if the deformation is large, like you get on these bright lines, it is also likely to have a fairly large nonlinear component. Right? Make things big, and they also tend to get nonlinear. What you can't see from doing this, though, is the relative magnitudes. That's where the interesting stuff starts to happen. So because we have both of these fields, and these are measured in the same units, essentially, we can take the ratio. and look at that as a function of space. So plotted here, the color map is actually the log of that ratio. Right, so there's four decades of that ratio on here. And you see some very sharp lines where the non-affine component's much larger than the affine component, and then a lot of other places where the reverse is true, with very, very steep gradients. So this is telling us something about localization of strongly nonlinear advection.
This is averaged over how many correlation times?
This is not averaged at all.
This is instantaneous.
It's advect. What we did is we put down these circles and we let them go and we calculated this deformation over two correlation times. But we didn't average over multiple frames. And of course, this whole pattern, if you now let time evolve, like initial time, would move around and wiggle around in the flow field. As you let the sort of time you integrate the system forward to evolve, it tends to sharpen. And actually, that's what I'm going to show next. Because there's a relevant scale here where you have one component beating the other, what you can do is just binarize your image there and ask just where is the nonlinear part bigger than the linear part, and how does that grow in time? So what I'm going to show here are in black, you'll see places where the nonlinear part wins, in white, places where the linear part wins, as a function of how long I wait. So in short times, again, everything is linear, to be expected. As you wait a little bit longer, you start to grow regions where the nonlinear deformation becomes important. They grow along these unstable manifolds at sort of intermediate times. Then they start to fill in the regions inside. And if you wait long enough, the entire flow field gets covered with places where the nonlinear term has or the nonlinear part has won. So if I plot area fraction where the non-affine piece is bigger than the affine piece, starts at zero and goes up to essentially one. And if you calculate, say, a box counting dimension from fields like this, it goes to two. Again, that's not surprising, right? Wait long enough in a highly nonlinear flow field and you expect that to happen, but it's sort of nice confirmation that the method we have here makes sense. Right, so it's really pulling out something that feels physical. Right, so essentially what we're doing here, to recap, is that we're isolating, or I would argue that what we're doing is isolating the sort of folding component of the mixing process from the stretching component. And we can directly compare where both of those are important. And there have been papers in the literature that you can find that argue that folding should happen in vortical regions and stretching should happen in straining regions. And what we're finding here is that that's not really the case, which is not surprising to me, that sort of everything happens in the highly straining regions because that's where deformation is big, right? Big regions, big solid body rotation regions don't do anything to you, they just spin you around. So it's a nice confirmation of that. So to sum up sort of this half of things, material areas, they deform. We know that they deform in a way that is nonlinear if you wait long enough. Those regions of strong nonlinearity, though, are initially fairly localized. In highly straining regions of the flow field, later they will grow to fill space as things move around more. The time scales of those processes are different, which makes sense. I didn't tell you, but that curve where you had the nonlinear part increasing and then jumping up, the sort of knee in that curve happens when the average circle has grown to an ellipse of aspect ratio 2. Right, because you can't fold a circle, you have to wait till you're stretched out some before you can start to fold. And then this is the question that we really want to get at next. Now that we know how to isolate this, in some sense all advection is nonlinear, but this sort of nonlinear geometry of the advective part, can we now use that to say something about what I will call Eulerian nonlinearity for lack of a better term? What I mean by that is generation of multiple length scales. So that's where we're headed. And I should say that we have a paper on all of this deformation stuff, which is out in Nature Physics. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit and think about nonlinearity in a sort of Eulerian sense, where what I want to get at is the triad interactions as you get from the nonlinear term. Right, so hit this thing with one length scale and generate lots of different length scales. Which means that you need to move energy and momentum around between different scales. So in our experiment, right, we have one dominant length scale, which is the magnet spacing. but you generate motion on many, many different scales. Right? And so how does that work in detail in our system? And then at the end of the day, can we connect that to the advection that's going on? That would be a nice thing to be able to do. So here's where we get into to why I'm calling this weak turbulence. I think probably most people are somewhat familiar with how 2D turbulence works. Just in case, I have this plot. This is a very nice plot of the energy spectrum in 2D turbulence from a DNS from Guido Buffetta from a couple years ago. In 3D turbulence, we have our typical energy cascade, where you inject energy at large scales and it cascades down to small scales. In two dimensions, things change because you have no more vortex stretching. Entropy becomes conserved in the inviscid limit. That generates an additional cascade, one of entropy. Entropy is now the thing that cascades downscale, whereas energy, the energy cascade turns itself around and cascades to larger length scales. So here's where you force. Energy flows this way. Entropy flows that way. But anytime you calculate spectra like this, again, you're doing spatial averages, or some kind of average, right? This is in an average sense, this is what's going on. So we'd like to get at this a little bit more, with a little bit more resolution. So we took an idea from that was developed by the Los Alamos group and the Hopkins group for how to look at spatially resolved fields of spectral transport. Right? And the idea is fairly simple. Essentially, all that we're going to do here, you can either call it LES or you can call it a wrinkle on a Reynolds decomposition. We're going to define some filter function, and the exact shape doesn't really matter, that is a low-pass spectral filter. We're going to convolve that with the measured velocity field. So we have all the scales, and then we're going to throw some of them out. If you then write down the energy equations for the filtered velocity field, you wind up with a new term, right? The same way you do when you do a Reynolds decomposition. That new term tells you about the interaction of the scales that you've kept and the scales that you've thrown away. And at the end of the day, you come up with being able to define a flux term, which is the inner product of the subgrid stresses with the resolved strains. And you can do a similar game for anything else. So this is for the energy. You can do something similar for the entropy fluxes. And you keep track of signs so that you know which sign means transfer to smaller scales and which one means transfer to larger scales. And you can make, you can do this, the nice thing is you can do this for any length scale you want, right? Because you just define a different filter. So there's a different cutoff scale, and you vary that cutoff scale, and you start to be able to see what's going on. So from our experiment then, same data you saw before, what we're plotting here is as a function of scale in the flow, divided by LF, which is the magnet spacing, we can plot the mean energy flux and the mean entropy flux. So small scales are here, large scales are out there. This is 1 right there. And the sign convention I have is that negative numbers mean driving to larger length scales, and positive numbers mean driving to smaller length scales. So what you see here for the energy, for example, is that there's more, this trough here is deeper than this little peak. You have more energy being driven to larger length scales than to smaller length scales, which is what you expect for 2D. The reason I would call this weak turbulence is that if this were sort of infinite Reynolds number, fully developed turbulence, you'd expect that you just have a constant energy flux at some negative number here, which would be essentially the dissipation rate or the energy transport, the spectral transport term, and it should be flat in some big inertial range. Yeah?
What kind of Reynolds number do you have here?
Based on the magnet scale and the RMS velocity, and the magnet scale is roughly the forcing length, this is at 185. If we go too much higher than that, at around 200, there's a shear instability that kicks in the vertical profile, and you start to mix strongly in the third dimension.
Do you have a significant bottom friction too?
Yes, it's a little bit difficult to measure because when we do the game,
you switch off the current and see.
Yeah, we did that. And when people do that, they fit an exponential to it and extract a constant. The problem is, our decay is not exponential.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little unclear to me where you fit.
It's been asymptotically. I mean, it can start non-exponential, but then go into exponential. No?
Yeah, so there's a sort of two exponential ranges, and it's not clear to me which one to fit. But yes, so there is a bottom friction as well. The long one? Yeah, we can do that.
In that flow, I mean, you've clearly chosen to put the distance between the magnets so that you have a lot of large scale, you're looking at inverse cascade, as opposed to small scales. Could you change that? Have you tried?
One can. I haven't done it. It's a bit of a pain. Like I said, there's 1,200 magnets in here. And you quickly start to appreciate Earnshaw's theorem. It tells you that with magnetic fields alone, you can't constrain objects in three-dimensional space. So the magnets like to jump around a lot. But we could do that.
But that would help the Reynolds number, wouldn't it?
Well, there's kind of at least three Reynolds numbers that you could define for this system. Right, you could have a Reynolds number that tells you how big the inverse cascade is, a Reynolds number that tells you how big the direct cascade is, and a Reynolds number that tells you the whole.
But if I define a Reynolds number as being the distance in spectral space I have between the forcing and the dissipation scale, then if you increase that distance, you might be better off.
You'd see probably more of the direct entropy cascade.
Because the question I have is when you look at your energy flux and you have some positive to the small scales and negative to the large scales, the ratio between the two is not enormous. So is it
not
a 3D effect or is it a low Reynolds number effect?
It's a low Reynolds number effect.
Oh, are you sure?
Because we're actually playing a trick here where this is a really two-dimensional field. Because what we do with that is that we take our measured data, and then from that we define a basis set of eigenfunctions of a stream function, and then take the data and project it back onto that part. So we're actually throwing away, well not throwing away, but we're removing any component here that is three-dimensional.
Right, but that's a trick. The physics itself, is there three-dimensionality?
There's always a weak Ekman pumping. It's on the order, for these Reynolds numbers, it's on the order of a few percent of the total energy of the system, the energy that would go into that Ekman mode. It will start to ramp up rapidly as you hit a Reynolds number of about 200. There's what I think is a shear instability that kicks in. You can see the energy in the sort of, if you do this game and you throw away the three-dimensional component, you ask how much you've thrown away, and you can see a sharp uptick there at a Reynolds number of about 200.
Well, it would be nice to check whether that double pump is linked to three-dimensionality or is linked to low Reynolds number.
It would be nice. It's a difficult thing to do. I can also tell you that as you lower the Reynolds number, this part goes up, which suggests to me that it's a low Reynolds number effect. So all this backscatter is coming from just you don't have a well-developed cascade. Plus, we don't have that much room for an inverse cascade. That's the other thing, right? So the thing is 86 centimeters and the forcing scale is 2.5.
And friction.
And there's friction, and yeah, it's... These experiments are challenging to get into a really turbulent regime, and I'm not sure if it can feasibly really be done in the lab. I think if you really want fully developed 2D turbulence, then DNS is the way to go. We can still learn interesting things, though. So, and the direct cascade looks a lot better, right? So there's the asymmetry between the sort of entropy cascade and the entropy backscatter is much, much cleaner. Okay, how am I doing on time? Okay, so again, these are averages, spatial averages, and it's always kind of fun since you have the field data to look at that. So what do we see here? So I'm gonna pick a length scale, I picked the forcing scale here, and then this is the field you get of the energy flux, right? So the color code here is that red values are positive, that means transfer to larger, or rather to smaller length scales. Blue values are negative, that means transfer to, other way around. Red means transfer to smaller scales, blue means transfer to larger scales. So it's quite inhomogeneous in space. The average winds up to be a number that says at this particular scale, the energy is primarily being dumped to smaller length scales. But at any given point in space, that's not necessarily true, and the sort of maximum ranges here are very similar. So by eye, it's hard to see that the difference between the two. And if you look at a PDF of this, the manifestation is you get a slight skewness, but it's only a slight skewness. You can do the same thing for the entropy flux. And even though this is much stronger, right, it's a more positive number, you still get a lot of spatial dependence here.
Sorry, for the energy. It seems we have strong transfer to small scale. It's always adjacent region that goes to the large scale. Is there common pairs?
Yeah, and I don't know why this is. We are looking into this. One thing that you see is if you take just a simple synthetic flow field and you play the same game, a flow field that only has one scale, you will still see a spatial distribution of these things. And they always come in sort of pinwheel shapes. So I have a feeling that some of these repeating shapes, these things that have rotational symmetry, are not exactly artifacts, but are something constrained by, if you have rotational motion, it has to do that. But I don't understand that part yet, and we're working on that. Okay, so there in the last slide I showed you these fields for one particular choice of length scale. You can pick, of course, any length scale that you want and calculate a field here. So energy on the top, entropy on the bottom, increasing from a little bit below the forcing scale to the forcing scale to above it. The first thing you see is that these sort of characteristic blobs get bigger as the scale gets bigger. We spent a lot of time worrying that somehow this is an artifact of the filter that we're using. And after changing filters around and doing lots of stuff, I think that's not the case. I think what you're seeing here is that the cascade is reasonably local. So that the dominant wave numbers involved in transferring energy or entropy at a particular scale are wave numbers of order that scale, which is not an unreasonable thing to expect. One nice thing about this is that it's hard to see from here, but I have a movie on the next slide, is that not only are the energy flux fields here smooth in x and y, they're also smooth in scale. So if I start at a small length scale and I just sort of increase, I fix time and I increase what scale I'm asking about the flux through, the field varies smoothly. So there's something that at least seems somewhat rational here, that this is a reasonable thing to do.
You don't have strong filamentation in your flow.
Not very strong, right? And I think, again, that's a low Reynolds number.
Strong filamentation, it would look very different.
I think so. I think it's a low Reynolds number effect. So all these things I've shown so far, though, are a little potentially misleading because I've only shown you snapshots. And of course, this field moves around in time.
Have you tried wavelet analysis?
I haven't done wavelets on this.
Because there is in the atmospheric community, there is some analysis of quasi-2D turbulence and transfer, and they find the same thing, that the transfer can be positive or negative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think they really have shown it convincingly.
Well, the one thing we know from numerical simulations, at least, is that the transfer is both sides with strong wings, and the average is positive or negative, depending on whether the cascade is direct or inverse. But we know that there are strong excursions on both sides.
Which is what we're finding,
It's fluctuating quantity strongly.
Very strongly, So in the PDF, the tails are large. But so we got interested in the time dynamics of these fields. Because if you watch them move around, right, they do move, they do change. The field moves and the values all change. So from the point of view of a fluid particle wandering around in here, you start to ask the question of, if I'm a fluid particle, do I see how uniform or how consistent, how correlated are my spectral properties? So as this thing moves around, I move around in the flow field, in this spectral flux field, am I seeing the same spectral properties? Am I jumping, hopping between these different islands? How does that work? So the sort of simple way we try to get at that question is to calculate along the trajectories of fluid elements the correlation functions of these fields. Right? So you calculate the autocorrelation of spectral flux at a particular length scale along the trajectory of a fluid element as a function of time. As I go from sort of dark blue to the red, I'm increasing the length scale that I'm asking about. And then, right? You start off at one, and you fall down, and you maybe dip below, and you wiggle around a little bit. So the simplest thing to do is to calculate an integral time scale. So just integrate that curve. That's why we went out so far, so that we were fairly sure that we were converged on these integrals. Calculate an integral time scale, and scale it by the velocity autocorrelation integral time, right? As a function of scale here, right? So one means that that at a fluid particle, right, my spectral properties are correlated just as long as my velocity properties are correlated. So that to me means that you're really, the spectral fluxes are being advected, right? So at larger length scales, larger scales, these fields are fairly well advected. Smaller scales, right, you start off where not very well correlated, so the advection is somehow weaker for the smaller scales. Then you start to, but it's reasonably flat down here, right, below the forcing scale. This would be in the direct cascade range. Then you jump up some and hit another plateau over a range of scales here, which is in the sort of reasonably strong, or the strongest inverse cascade regime we have, and then you start to just be advected around, which could also be an artifact of just having large regions of the same sign of this quantity. Capital T is the velocity.
From a Lagrangian measurement, not from the Eulerian.
Not Eulerian. So this is a long trajectories.
No. Given the points there, and you know, if you were going to say, it's pretty hard to interpret it as a set of plateau rather than a straight line. You draw a pretty good straight line.
You could draw a pretty good straight line. The error bar, that's why we were trying to be somewhat careful about the error bar. So it's a little harder to draw a good straight line that way. But yes, one could interpret this as being a straight line.
Did you track the long-range transport that you can follow the particle that actually goes from one corner to the other?
Yeah. So they don't actually make it all the way across the measurement volume in this amount of time. Right, so we have a big measurement area.
Now the word says that you put a particle trap in the localized region.
So we started, we have lots of samples going into here from all over the randomly placed in the measurement volume.
By the way, you want to put up your stick and show these guys the two guys.
And the other one would be this straight line with and that. I don't necessarily have a strong reason to argue one way or the other in this. This is qualitative, very qualitative. This is why I'm saying I'm not arguing strongly for one or the other. I don't have a good intuition for what this should be.
I was pushing an argument. I was just looking at the...
One thing we did try, though, was we tried doing the same game without actual Lagrangian trajectories, but just for points we put down and let just diffuse. Just do a random walk through this field and see, because it was we were worried again, since these blobs come in sort of reasonable size shapes, and the blobs are smaller at small scales and bigger at big scales, then what would you get? And you get a pretty darn good straight line. It looks much nicer than this if you do random walks through this field. So that leads me to think that this has a better chance of being real because of that check.
Random walk wouldn't be square root?
It winds up not being here.
So where's the conjecture speed?
One.
Okay.
Ish, right? So we played the same game for the entropy fluxes. Here, I wouldn't argue that that's a plateau. That would be very hard to argue. I wouldn't really argue any plateaus in here. But it also doesn't look quite like a straight line either. So I think that the trends that I can see from here is that the bigger you get, the longer correlated your spectral properties are, which is about the best I can say for here. And then just as a check, we played the those labels got funny. We played the same game for sitting at a point. Right, so now everything is being swept past me, right? The fluid velocity is being swept past, and the spectral fluxes are being swept past. So now this TE is not exactly the Eulerian correlation time, but I'm sitting at a point and I'm asking how long does it take for the velocity at my point to decorrelate from itself. And then this thing is an integral time scale for sitting at that point, asking how long does it take for the spectral properties to decorrelate. And you see this big hump around the injection scale, which makes total sense, and then it comes down, and then when you get big again, it takes a while for a big blob to sweep past me. And you see this in both the energy and entropy. Okay. And now you can see where we're going next. If I've shown you, every time I've shown you a spatial average or something, I then go back and show you what happens as a function of space. So now what we do is we take fluid particles and we start them all over the place on a grid and we let them all go and we calculate integral timescales for the autocorrelation along all of these different trajectories. And we plot that as a function of space for three different length scales here, right? So about half the forcing length, and a little more than twice. And what you see here is that, of course, the distribution is highly non-uniform. To interpret this, we've also put on, now this is actually the finite time Lyapunov exponent field. So the dark lines here are regions of strong stretching, regions that are attracting for fluid elements. So what you see is that the correlation times are long at for short filter lengths along those lines. But as you get big filters, you start to pick up dominant contributions from elliptic regions. So you're sitting there stuck in some region and everything's just sort of swirling around. You hang out there for a while and see a long correlation time. So the spectral properties for large length scales are stuck in big coherent vortices. and that also leads to bigger tails in the PDF of these correlation times. So increase the length scale and you get a bigger sort of exponential-ish tail out there. So a lot of open questions in this. We've only been working on this for a few months. Many directions we want to go. One of the questions that I'm very interested in, as I said, is what can I say about these instantaneous distributions? And I think simple things are not going to work here. The simplest thing to ask about for energy flux is that maybe it's related to this, to the strain, right? Because that's what you expect to some degree, and it's hard to draw conclusions from those instantaneous maps.
Entropy flux can probably can rather correlate with this strain.
And entropy flux looks fairly similar to the energy flux. Again, you can't really say much.
Just use what is called the nonlinear model, which is an approximation of the flux by the strain. And, and you can see that this model conserves energy in 2D. And that's the reason why it should be very positive value and very negative value.
I'll have a look. I don't know that one. So the one other thing we're getting to from this is my bias, and I think the bias of many people in this room, is that Lagrangian quantities will tell you a little bit more than Eulerian quantities. So since things are reasonably correlated along fluid particle trajectories, it's not an unreasonable thing to do to integrate the spectral fluxes along a fluid particle trajectory, or sort of average them, do essentially a sort of a path integral. And what you get is a field that looks strongly like any kind of advection field will have this shape, but the values are reasonably, they get sharper, and they start to correlate reasonably well with the lines of high stretching. So the lines of high Lagrange, so there's a much easier time, you have a much easier time pairing energy flux and Lagrangian strain than you do energy flux and Eulerian strain. So the black lines here are ridges calculated from this field, overlaying them on the path integral of the energy flux field. It sort of has to be that way. So I think to really push this forward, we need to do real magnitude comparisons. And one thing I would be interested to find, and we just haven't had a chance to do it yet, is the whole first half of the talk, I separated out the nonlinear part of the sort of advection from the linear part, and to see which one correlates better with the energy flux fields would be kind of interesting. So sort of summing up this part, there's a lot of spatiotemporal variation in both of these spectral flux fields. At large scales, it seems you could argue that the spectral properties are reasonably advected along with the flow field. At small scales, you see a lot of that for fluxes along fluid particle trajectories in strongly hyperbolic regions. And you start to be dominated by elliptic regions at large scales. And we would love to see if we can make any stronger correlations between these spectral fluxes, which are in some sense an Eulerian manifestation of nonlinearity, and these Lagrangian strain fields. A lot of open questions. The one I really am looking into now is can we use this in some way of defining a coherent structure in a rational way? Because now we have something that is localized in these sort of spectral transfer blobs are localized in space, they're localized in time, and they are localized in scale. And we know exactly what contribution they're making to the dynamics, and that they're doing a particular kind of cascade motion. So that seems to me a promising candidate, at least, for identifying coherent structures that we know what they do. So with that sort of teaser.
I'm going to make a short remark if I'm allowed to do split, but about this. So the question that you posed, what is it? The spectral flux, the way we understood it, like you say here, that spectral flux is a given nonlinearity. You may ask, what is the Lagrangian exact analog, let's say, of a flux in terms of, let's say, Hopkins' law? And it's in our this review of the list of the Gasoga. You can write time acceleration of velocity differences between two Lagrangian particles and squared. And that's average is epsilon. So in a sense, that's this kind of your Lagrangian analog of Hopkins' law. You can just say that this being translated in Galilean frame would mean the Hopkins law. So, but this is something about two particles, particle one, particle two, and you ask, for example, what is interesting here is that for 3D it's negative, and for 2D it's positive, which means that if you ask how this velocity difference depends on time, then for 2D it goes like this, and for 3D it goes like this. And eventually we know that, of course, it will not go up. But what I would really be interested to know, and was I never understood the results myself discussed at some point, would be interested in shifting your data. Could I read the flux? Let's say, I want to know where I am directly scheduling yours. Now, one way is to look at this quantity, and it will tell you if it's directly scheduling yours. But this is two-particle quantity, and I always wanted to know, can I take one Lagrangian particle, just follow me, so I can just take particle and take it to time t minus t plus tau, and square, and then average. And is it epsilon tau? Is it linearly growing with tau? Then I would call this, you know, a flux, because it's just energy term. So that would be very interesting. And I actually, I even wrote a wrong letter about it to Jean-François about a year ago, that I can prove that this cannot be, and then I changed my mind. So it would be very interesting, and I've never seen a consistent analysis, because we know that the flux is always about two particles, like Hopkins' law, or is this Lagrangian element. Can we read it from
a single trajectory?
A single trajectory.
Something that could be
experimentally.
It's experimentally you see it, but you cannot prove that it's like this. Experimentally in 3D, what happens is that if you follow a particle in time that goes from outside the box, inside the box, like this. It's always going to lose energy inside because experimentally the stirring is from the sides. So ddt of v squared of your particle goes down because it is not stationary for any particular particle and any particular field. That comment's been made by Mann, Eberhard, Mann and Berg. Several years ago. So you see it from that, okay? Yeah. But you cannot prove, I mean, what I was looking for and I haven't found is, you cannot prove theoretically where is the trace of irreversibility with one particle.
In this experiment, it might be a little bit different because we have our forcing not just at the boundaries, but the forcing is everywhere.
Here you can look at the box smaller or larger. You're scaling interval, now it's your time interval. So you need to take a particle, but after a while it would not be growing the velocity difference because it would be already on a box scale. So you have a relatively short interval of time during which to observe it. But you have very good resolution here, but still, I mean, that would be very interesting. Just one particle measurement. And then everybody shows.
have a different question. Could you tell us the advantages, disadvantages of your way to do 2D turbulence versus soap film?
So the things that I worry about some with soap films, it can be hard to estimate, say, the viscosities, because the gas around the soap film matters a lot. And so if you have fluctuations in anything in the gas, it can couple back to the film quite a bit. The other two reasons, it's a little harder to do particles in a soap film, because certainly the particle size is not at all small compared to thickness, and the natural thickness fluctuations of the soap film in rotational regions are not small compared to the depth. So here, I mean, I have an Ekman pumping, which means I must have some weak corrugation to the surface, but on a 4 millimeter scale, it's negligible. On a couple micron scale of a soap film, it's not. So I worry a little bit that the results are a little harder to interpret, because there are potentially compressibility effects that you have to worry about in a soap film as opposed to this.
Well, compressibility.
Or something
not
different.
Not necessarily bad.
Yeah, but it's
different. The point is, in a soap film, you have the thickness of the film, which is something that is really linked to the vorticity. Yes. When you look at the pictures.
So it's very coupled.
And that soap film thickness is a field that no one knows really how it relates to the rest of the dynamics.
What do you mean, how it relates to vorticity?
Well, you can't write the equations.
No,
you can't write du dt plus d thickness dt equal and understand how. Well, you know that one traces the other because of the pressure, obviously. Yeah. But
it's a little tricky in detail.
Yeah.
It almost looks like Kepler's theorem instead of Kelvin's, that you have like vorticity per density, and this is your density.
That's precisely what
is compressible, but now we don't have Kelvin's theorem. You have Kepler's theorem, yeah. And it's different. I'm not even sure how direct this scale is supposed to work in such case.
But then again, 2D with this type of thing is heavily criticized in a number of ways, because you don't know what's exactly happening at the bottom, and then
absolutely.
You have the interface. Which is why we take a lot of effort to... So experimentally, start. If you see it in both systems, I think it's a good sign.
Yes. The other thing about soap films is that if you make them big, and if you want to see any kind of inverse cascade, you need them big, they tend to sag under their own weight, which can be difficult then too.
So you need a lot of smelting depression. You could make a smelting film where you would have the height
of the thickness.
Is there some
viscosity would be fine to make a lot of smelting? You sort of distinguish this weak turbulence from like KL.
Haha, no. I would love to know a quantity like that. There's no definitions for any of these things, right? There's no definition of spatiotemporal chaos. There's no definition of weak turbulence, or there's no phase transition between them. So I don't know of a way to do this. A few years ago, we had one result from this flow where I think we can pinpoint, or we can argue that we have an onset of spatiotemporal chaos, and we looked at a sort of topological measure where you take these vortices, which all have a singularity in the center and a singularity at the edges, and you watch those things wiggle around and interact, and you start getting pair creations and annihilations at it's a real bifurcation, which I argue is a signature of the onset of spatiotemporal chaos. But how you then go from that to weak turbulence, I have no idea. And I would, if anyone has a good idea.
There are no sharp boundaries. You can say the spectra. Turbulence is about wide spectra in space.
And our spectra look terrible for this flow. There's a reason I didn't show them. For any kind of DC forcing like this, you see a big spike at the forcing scale, and then we sort of see a weak decay on each side of it. So it's terrible.
Just a little comment. And one thing that I have started investigating, and which I think one should go further on, is to see if you have 2D spiral chaos, for example, at angles of Relingen-R convection. You have vortices of E, you have vertical vortices of E, you have vertical flows. You have mixing. It's not 2D because it has clearly a 3D component, but it's quasi-2D. We know it's quasi-2D.
Yeah.
And so the question is, does it have anything? We started doing large, because there you can make very large simulations also.
Mm-hmm.
And these are real equations. I mean, this is real. It's not a 2D equation. You're simulating the 3D, and you only need three modes. And so I have data to look at. So this is the talk that I had advertised and took away again. I will give it.
Yeah,
and it's just for brainstorming. You know?
Yeah.
Just for brainstorming.
It'd be interesting. Because I think it's a good question of how can you relate all these things of effective dimensionalities. Complicated.
Okay. time to prepare yourself for dinner.